Welcome back to the Symphonies of Beethoven. This is Lecture 22, the third and final lecture on Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F Major, Opus 68, a group of lectures that I have called the Symphony as Program. We pick up at the beginning of Movement 4. Please remember, this is a five-movement symphony, not a four-movement symphony, and so this is not the last movement. Beethoven's title of this fourth movement is simply Storm. Time of day, late Saturday night, and early, that is pre-dawn, Sunday morning. The program, what is this movement about? It's about nature portrayed and nature as metaphor. We turn to Hector Berlioz, the wild man of 19th century French program music, for a description of this fourth movement. And now I quote Berlioz. "I despair of being able to give an idea of this prodigious movement. Listen, listen to those rain-charged squalls of wind, to the dull grumblings of the basses, also to the keen whistling of the piccolo, which announces that a horrible tempest is about to break. The hurricane approaches and grows in force. An immense chromatic feature, starting from the heights, pursues its course as it gropes its way to the lowest orchestral depths. Then the trombones burst forth. The thunder of the kettle drums redoubles in violence, no longer merely rain and wind, but an awful cataclysm, the universal deluge. It is the end of the world," unquote. Well, that's metaphor for a musical movement, I think. Berlioz is indulging himself as he was wont to do, but I want us to hear the movement just that way, as something that starts as merely a storm, but ultimately becomes a metaphor for cataclysm, disaster, the powerlessness of human beings in the face of God's nature. All right, let us begin from the beginning. The storm approaches, measures 1 through 20. I read from your word scores. The deceptive cadence that brought us into this movement, I would repeat. End of third movement, beginning of fourth. There has occurred no F major cadence to close movement 3. Instead, the forbidding and ominous rumble of approaching thunder grows out of a deceptive cadence. Note, Beethoven's thunderous rumble is in the low strings. He does not use the cliché, which would have been the drums at this point, the timpani. Beethoven wants pitch. He really wants us to hear the D-flat, which of course makes a deceptive cadence from the C7 chords that had preceded this rumble. And so he doesn't give us bum, 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 bum in the drums, because that would not give us the pitch that we need. We move on. At measure 3, a scalar staccato second violins portrays the first drops of rain. That sounds like this. Pitter-patter, 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 pitter-patter. Now, it's one of these strange and wonderful things that apparently all people that I've ever observed do when they feel the first pitter-patters of rain. And remember, this is night, so there's no light to illuminate the rain. Nevertheless, it seems to be a human reaction. We look up. We look up again. And indeed, after the pitter-patter phrase, we have a motive that is clearly someone looking up. Then more pitter-patter, and then more looking up in the air. Further pitter-patter raindrops and skyward glances are heard again, a whole step higher, and the tension is building. Oh, by the way, before we leave this pitter-patter music, this storm approaching stuff, I've got to point out something quite marvelous here, and that is, there's pitter-patter. Now, the brook theme from movement 2, the last chunk of water music we had, that's how it went. There it is. It's in a different key, but the brook theme, water music, gives birth to the pitter-patter, rain, more water music. Is Beethoven thinking about this? Of course he's thinking about this. This is a conscious act. This isn't even one of those unconscious, well, just kind of happened that way things that I've talked about before. He's got water before. Why shouldn't he get water again? Put it in a different key, put it in different instruments, change the repetitions of the pitches, And there you have it. The motive is the same. All right, at measure 19, a crescendo. Suddenly everything starts getting louder. The rumbling low strings suddenly get louder. My friends, it's time to duck for cover. Let's listen to this introductory music as the storm approaches. Kabang. You bet it's time to get out of the rain, because now all hell's going to break loose. Let's check it out. I read the word scores from measures 21 to 55. The storm hits. Dramatic tremolos, falling motors, and dissonant harmonies well depict the howling wind and falling sheets of rain. Note, please, the churning, purposely unsynchronized low strings brilliantly and theatrically portray the roar of the storm. Here, what Beethoven does is he has the contrabasses, the very lowest strings, playing upwards groups of four notes, and they sound like this. Over and over again. In the same space of time, he has the cellos, one octave higher, playing a group of five notes. And of course, when you put these two parts together, you don't hear the individual pitches because nothing is synchronized, nothing lines up, five against four, no way. What you hear instead is a smear of nasty, ugly sound. And the effect, of course, is one of uncontrolled rumbles in the back. The constantly rising bass line contributes mightily to the growing sense of meteorological mayhem at measure 33. Two flickers of lightning, played by the first violins, are immediately followed by claps of thunder in the entire orchestra. Measure 35, jagged unison descents in strings and winds portray a furious downpour, and we hear three of these descents. At measure 41, suddenly and dangerously quiet, ominous rumbling in the low strings, in all the strings, based on a very dissonant D diminished harmony. Then a single flicker of lightning is followed by a thunderclap, fortissimo. Then ominous quiet again, rumbling strings. Then another flicker of lightning followed by a thunderclap. These huge gradations of soft and loud, all based on the most dissonant possible harmonies. Then at 49, ominous quiet again, the rumbling builds. And that leads to, at 51, a bold series of lightning bolts played by the violins and earth-shattering thunderclaps played by the entire band. Lots of lightning bolts. Oh, boy. Let's listen to the music from measure 21. 255. Thirty-five. 41, 43, 45, measure 47, 49, 50. Yes, yes. There's no doubt about what Beethoven would be portraying here. Let's pick back up at measure 79 to 149. I read from your word score at 78. Torrential downpour, vicious descending arpeggios in the strings, and a massive descending scale in the low strings depict the torrent. At 82, the piccolo enters for the first time in the symphony. Again, Beethoven is very carefully saving his most extreme instruments for most extreme expressive moments. At 89, jagged unison descents further reinforce the sense of deluge, now approaching biblical proportions. At 95, slithering, dripping chromatic descents in the strings. At 103, the top voice rises as the bottom falls, the cataclysmic climax is at hand. And that's what happens at 106, as Berlioz called the cataclysm, the deluge, the end of the world. Trombones enter for the first time in the symphony. This phenomenal passage is both terrifying and awesome. Unsynchronized rumbling continues in the low strings, and a series of powerfully accented tutti chords follow. Yo, yo, yo. It keeps getting nastier and nastier. And just at the moment when we ask ourselves, is it the end of the world? Is this truly a metaphor for the obliteration of all things? Redemption. At 119, miraculously and gratefully, the storm gradually recedes. The world will not end today, descending scales and arpeggios, an occasional flicker of lightning, but the storm is indeed passing. Ominous rumbles in the low strings become shorter and shorter. All right, please, let's listen to this phrase starting at measures 78, 79 with torrential downpour, the move to the climactic cataclysm, and then the redemption. Either this piece was going to end with the obliteration of all things, or we were going to be granted a reprieve, and we have been reprieved. So let's listen to that material, please. Measure 89. Measure 85. 103. 106. I read from your word scores what immediately follows the moment we just heard the music stop. With great clarity and gentleness, a solo oboe sings a lovely, arcing tune. And we hear that lovely, arcing tune two times. Pictorially, this is the rainbow illuminated by dawn's light. A new day compositionally, this is an augmentation of the scalar raindrop music, which itself grew out of the brook theme of movement two. Please, the raindrop music. Our arcing rainbow theme. It's exactly the same thing, only the rainbow music is augmented rhythmically. Slowed down, the note values are longer, but it's the same thing. The rainbow music, as it was, as it is, grows out of the raindrop theme, grows out of the brook theme of movement two. Let's see if we can hear that in real musical time. I'm going to play you in succession the rainbow theme as it appears in the piece, then the raindrop theme, and then the rainbow theme again. Rainbow. Raindrop. And rainbow one more time. All right, let's get back to the word scores, because after having heard this beautiful rainbow theme, the ominous rumbles die off, and at measure 154, the movement ends with an upwards staccato flute scale, itself an inversion of the downward raindrop music of the movement's opening. Indeed, we hear a flute moving upwards, which will segue effortlessly into the next movement, the fifth movement. Oh, isn't this lovely? I mean, let's think about this for a second. The sky was falling at the beginning of this movement, and so everything was coming down. And now the sun is rising, and that is portrayed by the flute rising upwards. Down and up, darkness and light. This is all carefully calculated by Beethoven, just as a painter would calculate these acts, just as a set designer would calculate these acts in creating operatic sets and operatic lightning. So Beethoven is calculating very clearly musical icons that will represent storylines. Falling rain, rising sun. Let's listen again from the rainbow theme through the ascending flute, which then segues immediately into the introduction of movement 5. Movement 5, intro. And now we're in a very different place than we were just moments ago, expecting the end of the world as we were. Look, I have to point out the obvious. Since the beginning of movement 3, this symphony has not stopped. Movement 3 moved directly into movement 4 via a deceptive cadence, and I would remind you, so did the third and fourth movements of Beethoven's fifth symphony. Please, I would remind you. What happened at the end of the third movement scherzo of Beethoven's fifth? We had that particular excerpt, and we moved into the transition that brought us to the fourth movement via a deceptive cadence. And that's how Beethoven delivered us from movement 3 to movement 4 via what I called, correctly so, the first orchestral segue, the first transition between movements in the symphonic repertoire. And Beethoven liked what he'd done in the Fifth Symphony, so he does it twice in the Sixth Symphony. He gets from third to fourth movement in the Sixth Symphony via a deceptive cadence, and he gets from fourth to fifth movement in the Sixth Symphony via this flute ascent, which leads immediately to the introduction of movement 5 here in Symphony 6. What happens because of the connection of these movements, 3, 4, and 5, is that we have this constant sense of movement, a constant sense of almost operatic drama. We certainly don't have anything close to the classical model, which means start and stop between each self-standing movement. Rather, the last three movements are a continuity uninterrupted by pause. It's a very different creature than anything we would call a classical era symphony. All right, movement 5, Rondo. Beethoven's title, The Shepherd's Hymn of Gratitude and Thanksgiving After the Storm. And the religious implications during the course of the movement are such that we would guess this is indeed a Sunday morning. Time, Sunday morning. And what is this about? It's about personkind's gratitude to God and nature as a personification of God's gifts. The large-scale form of this movement, it is a rondo. That means we have the statement of a main theme, in this case, a theme we call the Shepherd's hymn, then a contrasting theme B, then we return to the Shepherd's Hymn because the concept of rondo is based on the concept of periodic thematic return, then theme C, a new theme, then again the Shepherd's Hymn, then theme B returns because Beethoven wants it to return, and then a coda in 8 parts. Sometimes in the past, not so much now that I'm teaching at a professional school, but in the past when I used to teach music appreciation to non-majors at a university, I was often asked, apropos of, let's say, the return of theme B, can he do that? Is he allowed to do that? Is he supposed to do it? And my response always was, well, it's done and he's dead. One of the few advantages, it seems to me, my friends, of being a dead composer is you simply can't alter your work based on the criticism of those people around you. This is why we should all affect a certain aspect of death even when we're alive, and that is, once the piece is done, you must assume that I have died with it, and therefore it stands as it is. Yes, he can do that. He chooses to go back to B before ending the piece. Introduction and theme A, Shepherd's Hymn. I read from your word score, measures 1 through 31. Introduction, Shepherd's Call. A sweet, rustic call to attention heard first in solo clarinet and then in a solo horn. Note, Musette-like drone, open fifths in the low strings. This sounds a lot like the beginning of the first movement, and it should. We have traversed a 24-hour day, we have traversed all the interior activity of the middle movements, and now we're back to a movement very evocative of the first. Theme A, Shepherd's Hymn. Simple, folk-like theme grows out of the Shepherd's Call introduction, and indeed also recalls Movement 1, Theme 1. So we've got a theme that sounds much like a theme we heard earlier in the piece, and that's what he wants us to hear. So first we hear that simply and beautifully in the first violins, and elegant church-like harmonies accompany it. Then at measure 17, quietly throbbing winds and first violin embellishment join the theme in accompaniment. It goes into the second violins, but it gets louder and bigger, and then the third version of the theme, A double prime. Wow, the formerly simple folk-like theme has become a majestic and glorious one, as majestic and glorious as any melody in the symphony. The tutti accompaniment imbues it with a distinctly cathedral organ-like sound. So let's listen now to the introduction and Shepherd's Hymn. Let's be aware of how each playing of the Shepherd's Hymn gets more and more magnificent, and how very religious this music sounds. I think Beethoven is trying to evoke the sound of an organ, especially in the third phrase of the Shepherd's Hymn. Shepherd's Hymn, phrase A. A prime. A double prime. Theme B in 3 parts. The theme is characterized by an expanding, rising motive, ever getting wider, ever embracing more and more pitch space. Though less tuneful than theme A, this theme is imbued with great momentum and energy. And in part 1 of this 3-part theme, a dialogue between cellos and first violins. Part 2, intense dialogue based on the final motive of theme B. I'll play that again. Note, compare this motive to motive 2, the dominant motive of movement 1. Boy, they're close. Oh, my goodness, they're close. We haven't come that far from the first movement here in the fifth. And part 3, two brief ascending phrases in the violins. Please, theme B, the first contrasting episode. Part 2. Part 3. Introduction, Shepherd's Hymn, A prime. And this is how a rondo works. We have a main theme that we keep coming back to periodically, and we heard that return of the theme after theme B. All right, theme C. Pastoral new theme, most probably based in part on a genuine Croatian folk song, followed by a transition based on the shepherd's call. Scalar staccato strings lead effortlessly back to theme A. All right, before we get to that point, I first just want us to listen to theme C, and then we'll talk about its possible relationship to a pre-existing folk song after we've heard it one time through. Theme C. Transition. Now, as I said, most likely, in fact, it seems almost irrefutable, part of this theme comes from a pre-existing folk song. First, I would point out that resemblance. The second half of Beethoven's theme C sounds like this. Now I'm going to play you a Croatian folk song from the Kuhak collection, volume 3, number 10. Well, that's not just close, that's identical. We don't ordinarily think of Beethoven as a folklorist. Indeed, we don't really start thinking about composers using folk music in fine art music until usually the mid-19th century. It doesn't mean it's not done, it's just not done commonly and frequently. But Beethoven's certainly doing it here, and why not? He wants to evoke a feel. This is a melody that he obviously likes, because that's the quickest way to find out whether a composer likes a melody, do they use it in their regular music? Well, Beethoven's using this, so obviously he liked it. So let's be aware when we listen to this movement in its entirety, which we will indeed have time to do at the end of this lecture, let's be aware that there is a pre-existing folk song stuck into this last movement, the second half of theme C. I will play now from that second half of theme C, and we will hear, through the transition that follows it, into A double prime, that is the return of theme A, introduction, and just the beginnings of the Shepherd's Hymn in its last permutation. So, Croatian folk song, second half of theme C, transition, and introduction and beginnings of Shepherd's Hymn. Transition. A double prime, introduction. Shepherd's Hymn, phrase A. A prime. Now, as we're listening to this last version of the Shepherd's Hymn, I would point out that it is a highly elaborated version. I would read from the word scores. At measure 117, a highly ornamented version of the theme in the first violins at 125. Ornamented version of the theme moves into the second violins. And at 133, A double prime ornamented version moves into the celli. I keep saying this interchangeably. I either say cellos, which is perfectly fine, or I say celli, which is more correct, but rather more snobbish. You'll forgive me, it depends on my mood, which one I say. This is a magnificent, almost royal chunk of music, and it is quite beautiful, and it brings theme A to its conclusion. Then we hear theme B one last time, much as we heard it originally at the beginning of the piece, and then we move on to the coda. What I'm going to do is describe the coda to you, read through the word scores, but rather than listen to the coda now, I'd rather we listen to the entire movement, and then we'll hear the coda in context of the rest of the movement. The coda is in eight parts, but in reality it's in three even bigger parts. Parts one through three are mirrored by parts four through six. That is, part one and part four are the same material. Parts two and five are the same material. And parts three and six are more or less the same material. So they are parallel structures, those two chunks. And then the true conclusion of the movement takes place in parts seven and eight. Coda part one, introduction, Shepherd's Call is heard majestically at first. Part two, theme A, the Shepherd's Hymn, is heard initially in the celli. I'm feeling hoity-toity, and bassoons. Other instruments enter in counterpoint with one another. Part three, it is a magnificent moment, for me, the second most magnificent moment in this movement. Religious ecstasy, shimmering, monumental passage sees long rising arpeggios in the low strings based on theme A. They embrace the orchestra. They surround the orchestra as a benevolent and majestic God might embrace the multitude. Then part four, which mirrors part one. Shepherd's Call begins in first violins and then moves downward in low strings. Part five mirrors part two, highly ornamented version of the Shepherd's Hymn, initially in the celli and bassoons, and then other instruments join in counterpoint. And then part six, more religious ecstasy, an even longer version of the shimmering instrumental passage heard in part three. The movement reaches its climax, after which a long, gradual descent moves the music towards my favorite moment in this particular movement, where I feel the climax is, at least expressively, Part 7, Hymn or Prayer of Thanksgiving. Beethoven has saved this most moving and inspired music for last. This simple, gentle hymn is a statement of great simplicity, dignity, and peace. It is based on theme A, the Shepherd's Hymn. Part 8, All is Peace, All is Serenity. Distant shepherd's calls in solo horns, wisps of a breeze in the strings lead directly to closure and ending. It's about as peaceful and about as lovely as any ending we will find in any symphony by Beethoven. So let us listen to the entire movement, and then when we get to the coda, please pay a special attention to parts 3 and 6, our religious ecstasy, and then my, it just shivers my timbers every time I hear it, part 7, that wonderful hymn of thanksgiving coming right at the end of the symphony, wrapping everything in a neat and a wonderful expressive bow. Okay, from the top of the movement, introduction. Actually, we're going to listen from the flute ascent that brings the fourth movement storm to its conclusion and then immediately into the introduction. Introduction. Shepherd's Hymn, Phrase A. A prime. A double prime. Theme B, Part 1. Part 2. Part 3. Introduction. Shepherd's Hymn, Phrase A. A prime. Transitional phrase. Mm-hmm. Prime Introduction. Shepherd's Hymn, Phrase A. A prime. A double prime. Theme B, part one. Part two. Part three. Coda, part one. Part two. Part three. Part four. Part five. Part six. Part seven. Part 8. Beethoven 6 is absolutely pure to its intention to create this sense of 24 hours of passing, and with it, the many moods and feelings that Beethoven himself feels and wishes to express in the symphony. It is as different from the Fifth Symphony as Night and Day, and the Sixth is as different from the Seventh Symphony as Night and Day. Here, at the age of 37 and 38, Beethoven's ripe old age, he's reached a point in his musical maturity where every piece of importance is completely different from the one that came before it and the one that comes after. That tenet of originality and self-expression fully operative now as we move towards the later symphonies. On that note, I thank you. We can look forward to the great dance symphony that is number 7. Thank you.